Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 17th, 1999. In the Koinonia Creekside room this morning is Lisa Kildegard. Her session number is 99-5. And the title is Through the Middle of the Streets of the City. Let's listen in.
Let me introduce myself. I'll put these over here so people can come in if anyone goes.
Or if you don't want to go, see your copy. Mm-hmm. I thought she was. She said she would be this
one. My name is Lisa Kildegard. And I teach at Luther College in the Department of English, which I highly recommend if you're going to teach. Go ahead and be in the English department because it's very fun.
None of that, you know, dry stuff about ethics or, well, theater's probably pretty fun too. Every year I get to read books and talk about them, and that's pretty much what I do for my living. In this class, for those of you who were here yesterday, you know the drill. It's really not a drill. And for those of you who are here today, welcome. In this class, what we do is we read poems and we talk about them and we explore them and we think about what they might mean and we kind of walk through them together and see where we arrive. It's very low tech, it's very low concept, and I want to assure you that I'm not here before you as a magnificent know-it-all expert, but as a fellow reader like you. So you have some things to share with me too, I'm sure. This year, the theme at Holden Village, as you know, is the theme, the Tree of Life, which comes from this marvelous passage from Revelation. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. On either side of the river is the Tree of Life with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of nations. Now you might think like I did that that's a rather complex and rich image. It has a lot of different distinct parts. And the poems that I'm reading at Holden with my classes this year are poems that seem to me to center around one of the parts of that image. So we have read poems about angels, we've read poems about rivers. Yesterday we read poems about the divine. We read a series of prayers. And today's topic is the city, flowing through the streets of the city. And this is a particularly interesting aspect of this revelation for me because it seems like, do you know on Sesame Street where they play that game, three of these things are just like the others, one of these things just doesn't belong. To me, it's as if there's all of this sort of nature imagery that all naturally fits together. You've got a river, and you've got trees, and you've got fruit, and you've got leaves. All of those things seem to be part of the same concept. And if you look at the gorgeous triptych painting in the village center, you'll see that it's all very brilliant, but natural images and colors. But where this river flows that waters the river of life, that waters the trees of life, it flows through the streets of the city. It flows down the streets of the city. And that seems to me to kind of stand out in that passage and seems a little extraordinary that you've got a city with an orchard. Maybe, I guess if you're from Wenatchee or from around here, having an orchard in the city is not so unusual, but I tell you, in Chicago, a fruit tree was a strange thing. With Chicago, where I grew up, it was strange to see a fruit tree in the city. Now, a fruit tree with 12 kinds of fruit, that would really have been, they sell them now, you know, grafted, you know, three kinds of apples on one tree. I'm sure they're taking their inspiration. So, streets of the city was a place for me to stop and think. And then I also got to thinking, how do our poets inhabit the city? And what does the city mean to us in the modern age? What does that seem to stand for us? So if you were going to just free associate some images that have to do with the city, what would come to your mind?
Busy.
Sidewalks.
Skyscrapers.
Cement.
Traffic.
Subways.
Noise.
Apartments.
Litter. Dirt.
Litter.
It's going to say noise.
Noise has come up.
Lots of sound.
Yes. In fact, I've got a friend in decor. We sometimes promise each other that we're going to meet at night in the downtown area and honk horns and yell at each other just to like remind ourselves of our previous life. Say, hey, you, get out of my way, you know, just to sort of act up. Which sounds like fun to us. The first time I crossed a sidewalk, this is a true story, I crossed at a crossing lane. What do you call this? Crosswalk. In Decorah, the guy behind the wheel went like this to me, you know? And I was like, I have the green. What's with you? And excuse me, I walk. And he was saying hello, so. I didn't really realize until this had happened a lot that people that I didn't know were going to say hi to me. And,
the thing that was hard for us when we moved to Decorah was we moved there from Manhattan, and in Manhattan, if you're going to be a pedestrian, you have to really be assertive.
Yes.
Because the people in New York will run you over unless you get enough of you out in the street. And so, road signals don't really matter. You just get across that street, because if you don't, you're not going to get across. And so we just routinely jaywalked, or at least crossed against the red. And so we were in Decorah, and I was with the boys. And it was red, but there's no one coming. I just started heading across the street, and Joel's pulling me back. You know, Dad, no, it's red. He said, what are you talking about? He said, it's the red light. He said, oh, yeah, there are rules.
Well, there's not that many in Decorah anyway.
Yeah, right? There's like five lights.
Our older son was really bummed out, I guess. He lived in outside of Phoenix. He lived in Mesa, but they went to Tempe where the university was. And it was late at night, you know, and he jaywalked and he got a $40 ticket. Because we're kind of a small town and people never worry much. I don't think anybody pays any attention to
him. Yikes. Yep, well, and the thing about jaywalking is you never make eye contact. Right. If you look at the driver, that's giving them permission to drive. So you're truly in the city.
You just walk.
You don't
right
make
after.
Eye contact at all. Small towns make a lot of eye contact. Okay, a lot of our images have to do with traffic, noise, and constructed, you know, construction, building, sidewalk, concrete. Anything else that we have a little bit of transportation, cars and subways. Anything else that might come to mind when you imagine the city?
Large park.
What?
A large park.
Yes, actually. Yes, large public parks. Yes.
Hurrying.
Quicker pace.
But you don't see the sun because of the buildings.
Crowds. Yeah, you're kind of in the valley between the skyscrapers. Crowds of people. Let's go a little bit with this. Crowds of people. What does that mean? You're in crowds of people, then what?
They're hurrying.
Quicker pace.
Gum on the sidewalk.
That's actually, yeah, and the color does it turn?
Black.
Lots of black spots all over the sidewalk. It's gum. Yep. What else about crowds?
Waiting in lines.
Pushing and shoving. Okay,
strangers
all around you. Steph, do you remember yesterday? Is that a good sign or a bad sign that you're in a crowd of strangers?
We just are.
Right? Does that have a positive valence in our culture?
It can.
How can it?
Well, you meet new people.
You meet new people, yeah, absolutely.
If you want to.
But
you
often don't meet them, though, right?
No.
I mean, it's not like you're not out there working the crowd usually.
No.
Yeah.
No.
You might want to be anonymous.
Why might you want to be anonymous?
You might be being private about something. You might be trying to get away from something.
Yes. Yes, you might enjoy being in a crowd. There is a vision of the beautiful city, Kallipolis, that I think right now in our culture is at an all-time low, and that we really need to, it really comes from, I suppose, this Greek, right? Beautiful and the polis, as in Athens, a beautiful city. A vision, and that vision actually comes from the Athenian model, a vision of the beautiful city, of what the city might stand for, what the city might be, about what the valence might be, the meaning, what the cultural significance of being in the city might be. Now, you haven't come up with a lot of negative stuff, unless you have a passion against concrete, right? When I ask my students, they often give me very fearful kinds of responses. There's crime, there's darkness, there's a dark alley, there's someone who means you harm. Right? There's property theft, there's drugs, there's the homeless, there's a lot of darkness in our cities. This image, I think, is very quick to hand, right? It's very prevalent in our culture. We have lots and lots of ideas about the pathology of the city. In our culture, we don't have as much expression of the beauty of our city, of what it's like to be in a crowd of people that are doing something together where you're anonymous, but you're still part of the crowd, the way you might be if you entered a church service. With lots of other people, you might be in step with them, you might not know them, you can probably imagine yourself worshiping in a crowd of strangers in a way that felt good to you. Can you imagine being at a large outdoor concert, such as they have in Chicago on the lakefront, being in a crowd of people that you don't know, not needing to know them, but feeling that you're a part of the crowd and that you're at this kind of cultural celebration? Interestingly, no one talked about the culture of the city, which is, for me, what I miss the most, the excitement of the amazing cultural institutions that you only get when a large group of people decide to live in the same place. Those are parts of the vision of the beautiful city, people participating together to create civilization, a place where you can be anonymous or known, but you can contribute your gifts in community. That vision, the power of that is, I think, right now at an all-time ebb in our culture. We don't hear about it very much. People aren't holding up city life as the apogee, the apex, the culmination of civilized life. We hear a lot about small town values. We hear a lot about the rural. I have a whole theory about how people began to talk about farms in a new way right after the farm crisis. You read a magazine like Country Home. When did magazines like that start? In the 1980s, right after the... So countryness has become a set of cultural signifiers that developed right after the farm crisis, right when all the farms went right down the tubes. People started reading magazines, right? It became a lifestyle, kind of. You hear a lot about country values, but where are the city values, the beauty, the glories of living in the city, where are they expressed? Well, in the passage from Revelations, it tells us to include that, the streets of the city, in our imagination of what the angel is showing. The angel isn't just showing a redeemed nature, although that's very powerful in the passage. The angel also shows a city, redeemed culture, in a way. And you can argue that the tree being an agricultural, thing is also culture. The city is a human construction. What would it be like to be part of it? Identifying things and honoring them. Good. What kind of guy is he then?
Generous.
Yeah, he seems okay. He's really generous with his words. It's one of the shorter poems. So, yeah. Yes, he seems like a generous character. Anything else you can say about him?
He seems aware of
very good.
Everything.
Yeah.
He encompasses all of it.
Yes. Yes. And I notice both of you are sort of doing this as he's like, yes, he's encompassing and he's highly observant. He notices so many things. Okay, anything else?
I'd say emotional.
Yeah.
There's dark parts and light parts and a range of emotion.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very good. I always get the sense when I read him. He's almost at times he seems like a big blubbery fool or something. You know, he's just very, very rich with his emotions. That's very good. Anything else from his voice alone?
I think one thing I like about him is that as a poet, he doesn't feel like he sees things differently. He's just seeing what everybody else sees, mm-hmm. and is just speaking it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no arrogance, there's no pretension mm-hmm. in it, which sometimes you can get, I think,
amongst
the poets.
That's true.
Let's see how beautifully I can craft what I see. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little tiresome. So I just like that aspect of it.
John Donne says that he'll build sonnets in pretty rooms. You know, this idea that the poet tinkers with a very fine, you know, which I like those poems too, but this is, he's a big train running downhill or something. It's just, and he is, and it isn't, there are some hard words in there. I don't know how to say it, contrariety. I've read that word 1,000 times. I don't really know how to say that, but there are some big words, but you do have the sense that he's got almost a normal tone of voice. Now, this is a highly crafted poem. He's been very careful to build it up in a particular way, and we'll look a little bit at that. But you don't have the sense that you do have, it does seem spontaneous in a way, doesn't it?
Didn't Pittman claim to be the voice of the common man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's very interested in common, he puts things into his, into his poetry, like prostitutes and murderers and the shoeshine boy and the just regular working stiffs he's got into his poetry.
I haven't just moved from the Manhattan area.
Uh-huh.
It just definitely felt like it does.
Yeah.
It just vroom, vroom, vroom.
Yeah.
It felt as if it had the
same kind of onrushing energy.
Yeah. Just kind of takes you like the city does.
Yes. That's good. Now, I don't think you probably bathed in the waters around Manhattan anymore. I think the East River's kind of over.
Jonathan did, but I did.
They do have a swim around Manhattan, mm-hmm. and they'll have to take a lot of antibiotics. And I have a girlfriend who's done that. Yeah, so it's got a kind of maybe a city pace, even though a lot of what he's talking about is beautiful nature things, the sun and the river and the sky and the hills of behind Brooklyn.
But he's got it all moving.
Yeah.
You know, even when he's standing on the ferry, he's in a hurry.
Yes, yes. And maybe, what do you think that sensation comes from? Is it the length of the line, do you think, or?
Some of the birds.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look, I almost think I want to say chapter by chapter as opposed to stanza by stanza because they're so long. In the section number one, he gives us a little preview of what is to come. What do you, just take a look at those lines, and what do you see that's important that's going to happen later in the poem? What stands out for you?
The hundreds and hundreds waiting to cross.
Yes. Hundreds and hundreds returning home are curious to me. Why does that seem to stand for you for something else that happens in the poem?
Just a lot of reference to folks.
Yeah. Yeah. A sense of thronging, maybe. Yeah. Of course, hundreds of people crowding to cross a river. Does that put you in mind of anything? Any mythological references? Could it be?
Exodus.
Yeah, could be Exodus. Yeah, could be. Or the River Styx, perhaps, or something about people gathering to cross a river that seem to be at some kind of critical point in their lives. There's a lot about life and death in the poem, actually. So that's good. Anyone else strike on any other passage there, just in that first?
He talks about the future being interesting to him.
Yes. Yes. You that shall cross from shore to shore. Who are those people? Anyone in the future who's crossing Brooklyn Ferry? Or, as it turns out, reading his poem, or alive in the future. So he's got this vision thing, right? Flood tide below me. I see you face to face. A flood tide is very much a thing of the moment, right? Right this minute, I'm looking at this flood tide. It's going to change in a second because the floods go in and out. I see you. And then he's got this shift by the end of the stanza. You that shall cross from shore to shore are curious to me too. And in the end, he's going to look. He's going to shift his gaze from that exact moment there into the future and look down the generations and try to see people of the future and do this with them that you were describing. Bring them into his poem and encompass them. I love the line, I see you face to face, and just look at the first line. Flood tide below me. Is that a sentence? It's a thing, right? So he gives a name. Flood tide below me, and then the next is his action. I see you face to face. What does it mean to see face to face? Now, just putting aside for the second that he's saying, I see the flood tide face to face, but I don't know that a flood tide has a face. What's that mean? I see you face to face.
Clearly.
Clearly. Clearly. I see you clearly, and this poem is about vision and what I see. Anything else?
As an equal.
As an equal. Yeah, that's excellent, right? Face to face. We're going to talk face to face. It's below me, but I'm not going to stay above it. Great. Anything else? Oh, there's an old joke about if you look at something, it looks back at you, but I won't go into this. But the flood tide that he sees face to face, it's like he's giving a face to the flood tide. If you see something face to face as an equal, clearly, then that sees you. So it brings you into its vision just as you're bringing it into your vision. So there's this tension that resides on gaze right here in the first line of the poem. Now, in the second stanza section, I'll say, he starts to name things. The impalpable sustenance of me from all things at all hours of the day. Well, what about it? Nothing. Here's another thing. The simple, compact, well-joined scheme. Well, what about that scheme? Nothing. Just names it. The glory strung like beads on my smallest sights and hearings. On the walk in the street and the passage over the river. What about it? Nothing. That's just it. Now, are these good things? Does this seem like a cheerful voice? Oh, man, yes, right? The glory strung like beads on my smallest sights. What's that metaphor suggest?
Bright and sparkling.
Yeah. What he sees is beautiful. It doesn't really make sense as a metaphor. How could you string a bead on your sight? I don't know.
I mean, where in the world is jewelry?
Yeah, the world is jewelry. That's good. As beautiful as beads. Of course, they sold Manhattan for beads. So probably has something to do with that. Hey, and then he named some other things. The current. And here comes a moment that's going to be important. The others that are to follow me. The ties between me and them. The certainty of others. The love, light, sight, and hearing of others. Here, this sense that you have that he's often called the democratic poet. That he's talking about equals. Notice how he brings in the sight of others already a couple of times here. It's not all about him, the poet, and what he sees. The sight of others is also important. Everybody, and Jim says that everybody's got this vision. He's just around to say it, so he does, right? The sight of others. Now, others is beginning this line and ending the next line, and then he starts one of his first little strings. Others will do this, others will do that, others will do something else. Right. And this happens, I know you notice this as we go along, he'll have this kind of rolling introductory word or two for several lines, and then he'll roll into something else and he'll go off onto that for a while. So what about the certainty of others? Nothing, he just notices it. And then others will do this, others will do that, others will do everything he does, others will see. Others will see the islands large and small, and others will enjoy the sunset. What about that? Nothing, it's just true. Others are coming. So we don't have any judgments or conclusions really for quite a while in this poem. He's just naming things. Now he's got a sentence that is more of a statement. It avails not time nor place distance avails not. I am with you, you men and women of a generation, or ever so many generations hence. Could you get to the end of this sentence? I don't think so. It goes on for quite a while. And what's his point now? I'm with you, and then he goes into a string of things, as you read so well, just as you did this, what?
He did.
I too. You and I, over and over again. You and I, just as you did this, I did this. And here's another way, I think, where he's kind of taking himself down a peg from being, you know, the mighty poet who stands up and delivers. He's saying, you did these things, and I also did these things, right? It's kind of a self-deprecatory. Now he gets into what he did after the break. Here he shifts and said, I too, and now it's about him more. Take a look just down, run your eyes. Are you on with me on page 117 on this, still on this third stanza? Run your eyes down this list of verbs that he begins the sentences with. The first sentence says, I crossed the river of old, I crossed. And then what are the rest of the verbs about?
Seeing.
I watched. What else? I looked. I saw. And after he gives us crossing, watched, looked, and saw is what he did. The most important actions that he takes for himself are in the eyes, right? What he sees. And then he runs out of verbs, and then it's just another list. What did he see? This bunch of stuff. Lots of ships, pilots, the white wake left by the passage. Anything here that really shocks you or amazes you? Anything that you couldn't see yourself on the ferry from Chillon up here? Well, maybe the tall masts. We didn't see a big steam tug. Very, very daily life kinds of things.
Yeah. What's a 12-month seagull? A December seagull? So it's just telling us it's December?
I don't know.
Full grown?
Oh, that could be at a year old.
Mm.
But they're not. They take 2, 3, 4 years to full grown.
Do they?
Change.
So it's a young one, maybe, perhaps. He's a juvenile. And he gets to the end of this, too. He hasn't really drawn any conclusions. He has told us, I'm like you, and how am I like you? I watched, I saw, I looked, I saw. I'm like you. Then he goes to the next stanza. These and all else were to me the same as they are to you. It's kind of similar to the previous. What's his next verb?
Love.
I loved. So he moves from looking to loving very naturally. It's not like a moment of, he doesn't shake you and say, hey, I really love these things I'm looking at. He just brings you along. I saw, I saw, I saw, I loved. So the next stanza is about how he loved. And he loved the cities, the river, the men and the women, others the same, others who look back on me because I looked forward to them. And the time will come, he says in parentheses, the only parentheses, though I stop here today and tonight. What does that mean? Rephrase that. Yeah, though I stop here, what could that mean? Yeah, if he dies,
yeah,
or stops crossing, or stops looking, if whatever he does quits. Okay, now we begin to change a little bit. So far he's just been describing and naming things, and not really pushing us towards any kinds of conclusions. But then he asks this question, what is it then between us? Who are the us in that question?
Everybody.
How so?
Between him and them. I mean, he's talked about the people of the future, mm-hmm, and today, and
So it could be the crowds on the ferry, or it could be what's between him and us, those of us in the room, right? So here's the first instance of a first person plural. He's been saying, you did this and I, you and I. All of a sudden it's us. But are we joined yet? No, why not? Something's between us, and he is going to find out what that is, what's between us. Well, of course, what is between us and Walt Whitman?
Time.
Time, right? It's right. What must it be? 130 years is between us.
lots of cultural history, lots is between us. Then he says, whatever it is, it avails not, and then he gets back into this I too, you know. We are alike, he says. Now in the next passage he says, he talks about the darknesses. Why do you think he brings that in? Here we've been talking about he's a kind of democratic, cheerful, generous poet, and here he says, the dark threw its patches down upon me also.
He's still identifying. You see, that whole poem is identifying with other people, and other people have darkness in there.
Yeah.
You see darkness, and he's identifying with them.
Yes. Yeah.
Almost seems like he had some sadness or something.
Yeah. Dark sorrows. Things he's not proud of. Why would that come after a question, what's between us?
To me, he's trying to connect with all people, not just those who see the beauty and the goodness, but those who have troubles and see the bad side of life.
Yeah.
So that it's more encompassing.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, so if you think that you're left out of his vision about how the sun shoots off his head in the water, do you get the image that I get of looking into kind of slightly murky water and having the sunlight come raying out? So people who just can't feel like they could have a place in that sort of a world vision, now he's bringing them into. And he's asked, what's between us? What's going to keep us from having this union? Could it be dark things? No, I understand those. I've done that too. I too. Been the wolf, the snake, the hog, not wanting in me. And he says, the cheating look, the frivolous word, the adulterous wish, not wanting. There's kind of a pun I hear on wanting, right? There, it's not lacking is the clear surface meaning, and maybe he doesn't want them either, not wanting those things but still having them. Look at how it switches. After the line, if you can see, was one with the rest, the days and the haps of the rest, was called by my nighest name, by clear, loud voices of young men as they saw me approaching or passing. Look at how he does a little pivot here in this part of the poem. Not all of this section is about darknesses and sorrow. And here he switches to things that are lovely, that are more about human connectedness and community, as he feels the arms of young men and sees many that he loves in the city. So suddenly he's come out of the darkness. Now notice where the pivot is. It's right between two lines that both start with the word was. Was one with the rest, was called by my nighest name, by clear loud voices. And so he puts the transition in between these two lines that start the exact way. It's part of his craft to blend the things together, right? The darkness and then what comes, he returns to love in the same stanza, but he connects them with the same word so that you feel them blending kind of together. Does that make sense to you? Walt Whitman was a person who had universal tastes in love and had very passionate relationships with both men and women and had a whole theory about the pleasures of the human body, which is actually not that extraordinary in the 19th century, but had very, very deep, loving, intimate relationships with both men and women, and celebrates them in his poetry, celebrates his body in the poetry in a way that was certainly expressed by other 19th century people, but would have put him in tension with some 19th century people too. So here he says, lived the same life with the rest, the same old laughing, gnawing, sleeping, played the part. So the darkness is included here with the love. Now seven, he then again starts to address us in this way, this weird way he has of creeping up on us, you know, step by step. Closer yet I approach you. What thought you have of me now? I had as much of you. I laid my stores in advance. I had considered long and seriously of you before you were born. What does that mean? Hmm. What has happened to his gaze here? Take a look at the next few lines. What is he, what's his gaze all about?
Is he trying to say that man does not change and therefore he knows us because we're the same as him, the same as the people in the past?
Yeah, that's good. I think that might be a part of it, that he can comprehend us in a way. Yeah.
It's future thing again.
Yep. When he says, I'm good as looking at you now for all you cannot see me, every time I read that I get kind of a little chill almost, you know? And it's not clear that he, when he says he's looking at you, closer yet I approach you, it's not simply the reader. It could be the people around him, the crowds that he's with, the mass of humanity, the crush of humanity. But it also reaches out into the future in really an extraordinary way, I think. And the fact that he's gone through this darkness and light and ended up with love is what allows him then to say, I'm getting closer. I'm getting closer to this union. And the union really comes in the next stanza. And you can almost see him sort of shifting his head in the sunlit water. You know, ah, Manhattan, and then I'm looking at you. You know, it's like both at the same time. Oh, what can ever be more stately and admirable to me than mast-hemmed Manhattan? And you can imagine the masts all around the river and the different ports and harbors making a hem around the skirts of the island that he looks at. He looks at all of these things. I don't know why the belated lighter. I don't know what a lighter is. I suppose it's something that comes in the evening.
Kind of a boat.
Yeah, is it? Mm-hmm. Does it have anything to do with light or fire?
I think it's a
lightweight.
Oh, a lightweight.
As I recall it, it just moves things from one place to another.
Yeah.
Like from the one shore to the other shore, not coming from way out in the ocean.
Yeah. And then he says, what gods can exceed these that clasp me by the hand? And with voices I love, call me promptly and loudly by my nighest name as I approach.
He likes that.
Yeah, the nighest name. He does. It's over and over again. What is more subtle than this which ties me to the woman or man that looks in my face? Here for, you know, up to now, it's pretty comfortable. He's talking about the people around him and the crowds. And then he says, which fuses me into you now and pours my meaning into you. And then all of a sudden he switched his gaze back on us. And look at the next word. We understand them, do we not? Here's the first we in the poem. Before it's been you and I, what's between us? We understand. Right? So the poem is kind of a journey up to this point, and we make a transition. He is pouring his meaning through the poem, and he says, we understand. What I promised without mentioning it, have you not accepted? What could that be, do you think? I really don't know, so your guess is as good as mine, actually. So just to be clear, there's not an answer here.
Is it his companionship on this sort of journey across the...
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Companionship.
Sounds good. Certainly a kind of connectedness.
Yeah. What the preaching could not accomplish is accomplished.
Yeah, you dumb, stupid minister. What the preaching could not, what does preaching try to accomplish?
Virtue,
mm-hmm.
Obedience,
mm-hmm.
Companionship, love, community,
mm-hmm.
Community, yeah.
Yeah, union. Absolutely. So you're made into like the body. The church body, and he's done that with his poem.
So the last line there of the section, which fuses me into you now and pours my meaning into you.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds sexual.
Yeah.
Pretty sexual.
Yeah.
Ties me to the woman or man that looks in my face.
There's also a famous story where Socrates tells his students that meaning is not like, the student is not like a cup. You know, you don't pour
meaning into a student, the way a pitcher pours water into a cup. And it's not, you don't learn by capillary action either, you know, that the process of learning is different than that. But this is very much a, he's the pitcher and we're the cup, yeah. And he may be using more of the water imagery that's been dominant in the poem, the flowing of the tides and the flowing of the river, and now the meaning has become watery too. But yeah, you should see it as sexual, not because, oh, it's about sex, but because it's a powerful way to talk about connectedness between people, right? So using a sexual image as a means to something, it's not an end in and of itself. You don't quit when you find out that, oh, there's sex parts in here. Oh, well, it's about sex then. You take that and you think, why would he use such an intimate kind of description for this? Because he's really talking about this kind of fusion and companionship that's kind of spiritual in a way, uses the body, might be beyond the body. Section 9 then, it's as if he's done what he needed to do in Section 8. I really see Section 8 as the climax, thank you for that, of the poem, I really do. This seems to me the center, powerful part. And after that, he turns back away, and he begins this kind of benediction process. And then he starts to use, he has a different construction here. He uses imperative verbs. And he starts to tell things what to do. Do this, do that, flow on, frolic on, cross from shore to shore, stand up, throb, do all this stuff. And it's as if he's gotten to a place where he, oh yikes, he's gotten to a place where he now can just celebrate what's happening and endorse it and name it. So we get this long list of all these things together. It's a big onslaught of images as it goes by. Be firm, do this, do that. And then he has this extraordinary line, appearances now or henceforth, it's about halfway down on 120, indicate what you are. You necessary film, continue to envelop the soul. What is that all about? Well, how do appearances indicate what they are in this poem?
So much of the poem hinges on what he sees.
Yes.
That appearances are crucial.
Yes. Yes. And to be celebrated. Appearances are so important because that's what you look at and that's how you receive your messages. But they are only appearances. They don't separate us, right? You look at them and you see things and you name them, but there's some kind of life beyond where we find this kind of union, where meaning is poured back and forth. So he's not a Platonist who would say, oh, appearances are just false, they're false messages. For him, they're real messages, but there's still a world beyond that he's trying to get to and get union with. You necessary film, continue to envelop the soul. He celebrates both the way things look and the reality behind them. And then he says, you always wait, you dumb, beautiful ministers. These are not ministers in the church, but messengers that come to his soul. They're dumb, they don't speak, but through his looking, he allows them speech. And again, he comes back to we. And we have this kind of exalted we at the end. We do this, we do that, because he's gotten us on board with him. We've gotten onto the ferry with him. We're connected to him, and we're celebrating the world as we all see it together then. Now, in this poem, all the messages from the city are good. He embraces the hustle and the bustle and the noise and the human structures as well as the natural structures he sees around him. And on the river, he looks at the streets of the city and sees so much to celebrate and hold up. Because what does it bring him? It brings him this incredible sense of human community, right? This sense of being one in the crowd, still a stranger, but not a stranger. Right, he grasps people by the hand, he looks them face to face, he still remains in his own identity, maybe anonymous in the crowd, but part of this other thing, this community. And that's what he sees the city able to do. And that's a vision to me of what a city could be like, and never is.
It never is, any more than the small town completely upholds small town values. But it's a powerful vision of what. Thank you, you're wonderful readers. And this was the long haul. This particular poem, we'll be reading shorter ones in the future. If you come back, we will do those together. There are comments or anything that needs to be said?
Nighest name.
Pardon me?
Nighest name.
My nighest name.
Simplest name, sort of.
Evening is nigh. What does it mean when people say
close?
Near.
Near,
close by. So my nighest name, my first closest to me, I think. Yeah.
Your nickname.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the most personal.
Yeah.
How about the dumb, beautiful ministers?
Mm-hmm.
I was imagining buildings in Manhattan, or the ships.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's right.
I think that is part of it. Look at the line right above. Keep your places. Objects than which none else is more lasting. So I think he's talking about objects because he tends to do this, pick up in one line what he's left behind in the line before.
Mm.
So I think it is the buildings and the ships and the solid things that don't actually seem so solid anymore now that he's gotten closer to them. Yeah, they don't change. Furnish your hearts toward this alone. And there's a whole thing about acting in here that I don't quite get, but I'm going to talk about sometimes.
She wants to keep this.
Actually, sometimes.
Yep.
Are you taking these back?
I'm taking these back. Home class. I'm returning these back.